This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 99, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And I'm starting something new where every Thursday I'll be releasing episodes called UFO Encounters, so please check them out. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign where there are now more than 90 episodes in the back catalogue. For $5 a month you get an extended episode every week, and for $2 a month you get an extended episode every month. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Mark Hartzman about his book, We Are Not Alone, The Extraordinary History of UFOs and Aliens Invading Our Hopes, Fears and Fantasies. In addition to his book about UFOs, he has also written about ghosts, Mars, Oliver Cromwell's embalmed head, weird things on eBay, sideshow performers and unorthodox messages from God. Mark has written for Mental Floss, HuffPost, AOL Weird News, AllThat'sInteresting.com, The Morbid Anatomy Online Journal and Bizarre Magazine. He's also discussed oddities on CNN, MSNBC, Ripley's Radio, History Channel's The Unexplained and the Travel Channel's Mysteries at the Museum. Hi Mark, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Simon. I appreciate it.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called We Are Not Alone. One of the things I really like about the book is you present kind of a balanced viewpoint. It's not like you just give the cases and say, this is what happened. You also present more skeptical viewpoints from other investigators.
Yeah, I like kind of going down the path of not trying to have a particular agenda. I just like presenting the material. I find it all fascinating, you know, whether if there is material from skeptics that can help explain a particular sighting, I think that's really interesting and people should know. And when there's not a way to explain a case, you know, that's also obviously that's incredibly interesting, right? That there's something that happened that people experience that no one seems to really have any explanation for. So I like presenting both sides. I think it's, like I said, I think it's fascinating both ways.
Yeah. And it's good to get that viewpoint because you can't be kind of like a true believer. And so no matter what you hear, you go, oh yeah, it's all true. It's all true. And just shut your mind down to anything that might contradict your belief.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have to be open to all the possibilities, right? And there is so much, you know, one thing, I spoke with a lot of different scientists in my research for this book. And one thing that one of them mentioned to me is that, you know, science takes time and data takes time to collect, especially in cases like this where everything is so transient. So people's minds want to jump to an answer and they don't want to be patient for science to find, you know, what an actual answer might be. And maybe that is real, you know, extraterrestrials, that's certainly a possibility, but there might be other answers as well. But our minds want answers quicker. And so oftentimes we'll jump to that answer, whether it's the real one or not.
Yeah. And also scientists don't know everything. They can come up with ideas of what it might be, but there is a sort of feeling, I think, in society sometimes that scientists are the gatekeepers of what is real. And so if a scientist says, oh no, UFOs aren't real, then there are so many people who just accept that and say, oh, well, the scientists say it's not real, so it's not. But
true. And you're right. We don't know everything. And that's part of what makes all this so interesting is we don't know everything and we're going to learn more soon. I mean, I kind of feel like people have always probably thought everyone knew everything at some point, right? Like 100 years ago, people thought, oh, now we know almost everything. And look where we are, you know, a century later, stuff that no one would have ever imagined. So who knows what might still be unknown to us that we're going to discover in one way or another. It's exciting to have these mysteries still.
Yeah, I heard a phrase that said something like, what scientists do is find better and better ways of being wrong. It's like they're always refining the theories. And then every now and then you hear something in the news that like, oh, the James Webb telescope has found out this thing. And now astronomers are saying, oh man, we've got to revise all our theories on this.
That's true. We got to rewrite the textbooks. And
yeah. And also, you know, NASA had a press briefing recently because they've been tasked with looking into UAPs, as they call them. I like to call them UFOs, but maybe that's just because I'm so old. But I think NASA was saying, oh, yeah, we're bringing science to this. We can use the scientific method. But the thing about UFOs is they're so fleeting and there's so little evidence, or you could say there's no evidence, there's nothing physical. So how can you bring the scientific method to studying UFOs?
Well, I think for one, I think it's good that they are making attempts finally, like that they're taking an interest in exploring it. And I like that Bill Nelson said at a recent briefing, what was it, September, I believe, he said that they're trying to take UFOs or UAPs from sensationalism to science. And so I think that's a good attitude, you know, that they're no longer treating it as something with a stigma that they shouldn't be paying attention to. And I talked about in We Are Not Alone, you know, Avi Loeb's program, the Galileo Project, where he's one of these, you know, particular scientists with a ton of credentials and a lot of resources. And so, and he of course, for listeners who might not know him, he's the one who proposed that Oumuamua, this interstellar object that passed through the solar system in 2017, was an extraterrestrial object, you know, some sort of alien architecture, so to speak. And so he's very open-minded about it. And because he's had success and funding, which is important, he's gathered more than 100 scientists to help him. So he's got technologies, telescopes, and so forth to actually start collecting data of what's passing through the solar system. And you're right, it is all very transient, but at least they're starting to collect some data on their own and they have the means to do it. And maybe they can learn something from that. And you wonder, like, what might we know today if scientists had taken that attitude and had those capabilities, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago, instead of pushing it aside. So to me, it's like it's a way that there's finally hope that maybe we will get some sort of, you know, more solid evidence on something.
So if we can talk about some of the cases in the book, which is fascinating, and there's one that you have at the beginning that I don't think anybody else has written about, which was Charles Davis and the spinning top. Can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, I love this story. This is such an unusual one, which I thought was a fun way to start the book, was something that most people probably had never heard about. And I came across this when I went to visit a researcher and historian named David Marler, who has a remarkable archive just outside of Albuquerque. So, of course, I plan to go through his materials and then drive to Roswell after a couple of days and visit there. So it makes for a good trip to New Mexico. And when I was there, as we were talking about just different cases and so forth, he mentioned he had met a guy who lived in Roswell now, who had an experience when he was 8 years old in 1964, and arranged for me to meet with him when I was up in Roswell. So this man, he basically, when he was a kid, he was playing outside of his grandmother's laundromat. This was in Hobbs, New Mexico. And it was just a big open parking lot behind this laundromat. And he's just, you know, playing. And he sees this thing like across the way, across the street, about treetop level high or so, top shaped. And it's kind of mimicking his movement. So if he moves to the left, it moves to the left. If he moves to the right, it moves to the right. And doesn't know what this thing is. And all of a sudden, it just zips over to him, right above his head, and then belches out flames over his head. His grandmother at this point stepped outside and witnessed this. He was burned from the chin up, and she rushed him to the hospital, where there was fortunately a burn specialist on staff at that moment, and he was treated quickly. And fortunately, he recovered, but he talked about how, you know, horrific he looked at the time. The FBI came and investigated the case. They could find no trace of anything that would explain what happened to him. There was nothing on the ground, none of the machinery coming from the back of the laundromat. None of this would have caused anything that happened to him, basically, or that aligned with anything that he said or his grandmother said. So there's really, like I said, no trace of evidence of anything that would have caused this, which is incredibly bizarre. So he, like I said, he was with the FBI, and then he didn't really speak about this because people, you know, he didn't really know what it was. A few years later, James McDonald talked to him and his mother and grandmother also. And that was, I think, 1968. And after that, he really never spoke of this again. He just kind of put it in the back of his mind and moved on with his life. And it wasn't until David Marler tracked him down and met with him. And then a few years ago, and then I met with him a couple of years ago during my research. He just really never talked about this case. But as David told me, he further researched this, and I talked about this in the book, and found that there were other similar incidents in the months just before and after this of other top-shaped UFOs going over people and shooting down flames. Another man, I believe, in either North Carolina or Georgia was burned also on the arm. So there's all these weird cases. Why was this happening around this time in 1964? What were these things? There was never any explanation for them. Obviously, you know, the FBI looked in the military, you know, were they testing something? They got no evidence that that was the case. So it's one of these truly bizarre cases. And like I said, I loved opening the book with a really odd, obscure, bizarre case that has no explanation, because that's kind of the nature of all this, right? Like, they are odd, strange cases, and many of them we don't have answers for.
Yeah. And also, it makes you wonder how many other cases are out there, because that guy, he'd never really talked about it. And it was almost like that case is completely forgotten about. And I think there are some people out there who might have UFO sightings and experiences, and it's almost like they're not that fussed, and they just get on with their life and they don't really talk about it to anyone.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, you do wonder how many go unreported, and especially back then when maybe, you know, people were going to look at you funny if you said you'd seen something, right, or had some experience and would not be receptive to it. I think that's attitude is changing now, which is good. But yeah, you do wonder how many people have had weird things happen that they just kept quiet, or maybe they did just move on. I mean, it's as much as we think that if we discovered alien life somewhere, it would change all of our lives. You wonder how many people would just find out and just get back to scrolling through their social media or something and just not even thinking about it. So yeah, it's interesting to think how many people might just have had something that they could have shared and just kept it to themselves.
Yeah. And there's something else in the book. You talk about the US Air Force Introductory Space Science Chapter 33, which almost sounds like what they're describing in that chapter is knowledge that they've gained that is just accepted to be the truth. But now that chapter was removed, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's such an interesting fact that there was this chapter, these young cadets, to teach them basically about ufology, right? Like, this is what we believe has happened. And they believe that there have been visitations since, I think it said like 5,000 years ago. So they were looking at going all the way back, that this was something that was possible. And they described a bunch of different cases and the different kinds of aliens people had you know, described seeing or confronting in some way. And then, yeah, it was taken out. I think it was taken out just after Blue Book closed. So it certainly makes you wonder, like, they just said, okay, we got to change the narrative now. We're back to no UFOs.
Yeah, because they describe different ETs, don't they, and what they look like. And it's like it's a textbook. Like, we take this for granted. This is the truth. This isn't guessing or anything.
That's how it's presented, yeah. Like, this is what it is. You know, they've got, they cite their different sources in the bibliography, and it's a pretty fascinating little hidden, lost chapter.
And so when you're looking at all this different UFO stuff over time, you've done a lot of research and talked to a lot of people. When you started out, were there things you heard about and you just thought, oh no, I can't go there. They're just going too far. But later, after more research, you start thinking, hang on a second, there might be something to this.
That's a good question. You know, I think certainly the one thing that's really odd is the idea of, I'd say, like, you know, the hybrids, are they among us? Which is related, obviously, to abductions. It's like the next level of abductions, I guess you could say. And that's definitely an odd one, right? Like, I think that's a tougher one to just assume is happening to so many people. But what's amazing is you hear these cases and people have these memories, and they're very confident about them. And, you know, it does make you wonder, could something more be happening? You know, if we're seeing something out there, is there another level to it? You know, are there, you know, these other degrees of close encounters where those kinds of things actually are happening to people? And like, I mean, I spoke to, you know, someone I've gotten to know quite well told me about one of his cases, and it's hard not to believe what he's saying. I mean, these people feel very sure of what happened in their lives.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of people on this podcast who talk about their alien abduction experiences, and some of them are a little positive about it. Some of them say it's all bad. You talk to Kim Carlsberg, and she talks about meeting hybrid children. But I think she also talks about how her body is so badly affected, she can't have children now. It's almost like the doctors would look at her and say, what have you been doing? You know, you've wrecked your system.
Yeah, I mean, she claimed to have had many abductions. And Kim Carlsberg is such an interesting story. She was a camera woman for the show Baywatch back, you know, in the, I guess, late 80s, early 90s, and was having all these experiences starting around that time. And like you said, claimed to have met one of her own hybrid children who came to her home in his craft. And she was a camera woman, as I mentioned. So she ran to get her camera equipment because you'd think, like, if anyone's going to get a photo, you know, it should be the camera woman. But she had all her equipment locked up in the back. By the time she could get to it, she realized it was going to be too late to do anything. So she just had that moment to herself with this hybrid child of hers. And then that was it. It was kind of a quick moment, but interesting to hear her description of it, all of which is covered in the book. But she also talked about the government taking her after these abductions to like underground bunkers or something like that and interrogating her about what had happened. So she said this happened all the time. And the whole crew of Baywatch knew about all this. So they would talk to her about it on set, asking her questions. And then one day she mentioned she was late and her producer came up to her saying, come on, you're late to the set. You got to see what we have for you. And they'd set up all these different radio telescopes on the beach and they were creating an episode of an alien abduction for Baywatch. So kind of love that her story ended up making an impact on pop culture. And it's now an episode of Baywatch, which I thought was pretty interesting. But yeah, she was definitely, I mean, she told me her so many stories and was completely sure all this was happening. There was no doubt in her mind.
And you do talk about more skeptical viewpoints of the alien abduction phenomena, whether it's sleep paralysis, or perhaps it's false memories brought up in hypnosis. What's your view on these things?
Well, I think these are possibilities. You know, again, nothing's to say that this explains everything. But studies with sleep paralysis show that, you know, certain people might have certain experiences that are very similar to what people have described in terms of abduction stories, you know, the aliens that they believe that they're seeing and the experiences they're having. So there's some data on that, but again, that I think that might only explain some stories, but not all. And then, you know, different people who've worked with hypnotic regression have talked about, again, on one hand, that very convinced that this is all absolutely for real. And others that acknowledge that in some cases it might be sort of masking other memories from the past as a way to get through some other trauma. And so that's also, you know, in my mind, that's a possibility for some cases. And that's kind of how I present it. Like, I'm not saying that, and that's why, you know, that explains the Betty and Barney Hill abduction story. I'm not saying that by any means, but it is interesting to look at these different possibilities of some things, you know, terrestrial explanations for some of these sort of extraterrestrial encounters.
I kind of feel that just about everybody who would do a hypnotic regression to investigate possible abduction with aliens, they've got to have a reason to go there in the first place, like normal memories that haven't been brought back by hypnosis. Like they remember seeing the UFO or they remember something happening in their bedroom, so they want to investigate it. when I studied it, we were told that when you regress people back to their childhood or something, you can't rely 100% on what comes through. Maybe 30% of it may be false. But at the same time, you don't know which 30% is false, so you can't rely on any of it. But also, the hypnotist has to be very careful not to use leading questions and suggest things.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So you're making sure that whatever you're pulling out is as authentic as possible, right? And it is interesting. Like you said, I think usually something will trigger that memory. Maybe they'll hear another story and suddenly you have, you know, a memory come back to them. It wants to learn more about that and then go into that session. One of the people I spoke with was retired Air Force Captain Robert Salas, who had an experience at the nuclear site in Malmstrom, Air Force Base in Montana. And this was in the 1960s. And then in the 80s, he had an abduction experience he talked about. And he said he went to, I think, 5 different hypnotic regression sessions with different hypnotists. And everything came back basically the same consistent story, which gave him confidence that what he was, with these memories coming back to him were real.
And I did hear that Bud Hopkins had a technique that he'd use while he was going through that process. He'd say to somebody might say, oh, I'm in this spacecraft, I'm with these ETs. And Bud Hopkins would test them and say, do you see the guy in the yellow shirt? There's always a guy in a yellow shirt on the side. And he was testing them to see how suggestible they were. And if they said, yeah, I see the guy with the yellow shirt, then he'd know. But if they say, no, there's no one here like that, he could gauge how much this person could be led, which helped him kind of work out how much truth there could be.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great technique to certainly try to understand. Like you said, is this person going to be too suggestible for us to really take what we're getting from it entirely seriously? So. Yeah, I think something like that obviously makes a lot of sense to be sure of what you're getting is as true as possible. And he worked with hundreds of people claiming they've been abducted. So he collected a ton of incredible data.
Yeah, and also John Mack did it. And I think he's a great researcher he's got more gravitas, I suppose, because he was a Harvard professor. And he's a psychiatrist, so he's got a much better idea of what is psychosis and schizophrenia and if people are fantasy prone. So he'd be a really good guy to research this.
Yeah, and he also, I mean, he got to know Bud Hopkins and they did a bit of work together. He also, worked with a lot of different people who had these kinds of cases. And like you said, had the credentials and the understanding. And he believed that clearly something is going on. People aren't just having these memories for no reason. So he was truly fascinated and open-minded and wanted to explore and just find out what is happening. Why are people having these memories? Where's it coming from? And he was very open about his research. And, at that time, Harvard was not thrilled by that. He went through some issues at Harvard, but I think he eventually got past that. But, there's that stigma still applied to the idea of UFOs. And especially abductions. And he didn't worry about that. He got past it to do his research.
And I think that Harvard were trying to remove his tenure and he was fighting it and it nearly went to court. And it was only when it appeared to Harvard they're going to have to go to court for this that they backed down and said, all right, he has the right to do any type of academic research he wants.
Yeah. Yeah, and he just marched forward and did it, which I think is great. He was fearless and he was curious, good qualities.
And I wonder if the court case might have also been almost a test in court if abduction is real. And I think John Mack said that he had several clients. He'd maintain their anonymous status, but they said, "We'll come. I'll come to court and I'll speak for you." And he had people like high court judges and. Really important people, and maybe that put Harvard off a little bit.
Yeah, you kind of wonder what that case would have been like. Imagine the stories coming out of that court case.
Yeah.
And just the general nature of that court case, trying to determine in court whether or not this is a real thing, or I guess at the least a valid line of research to investigate.
Yeah, because I wonder how much support people who have this get. If you go to a psychologist, a local person, and say, "I believe I'm being abducted by aliens," if the psychologist, they have no experience with it, they might not be able to handle it, and they might even reject that person and say, "I can't take you on as a client." And it seems to me that maybe the profession needs to do a bit more to look into this and help the people, rather than taking it for granted that they're just making it up or they're delusional.
Yeah, I imagine that you're right. You probably wouldn't find a ton of people who are like, "Oh, let's investigate that further." They might just make some quick assumptions. Again, all sort of dealing with that stigma that's been with this topic for some 80 years, that only people who are nuts in some way are having these experiences. And you see, that's what's so interesting about more current cases, is you're seeing that there's more and more credible people having experiences, and that it's not the case that you have to be that you're a kook if you've seen something. Lots of perfectly credible people have had experiences or seen things that are just truly unexplainable, whether it's abductions or seeing something overhead in the skies.
So can we talk about Robert Salas and what happened at Malmstrom? Because that's just one of many of those sorts of things, isn't it?
Yeah, there were quite a few cases. So I went to hear him speak at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. It was October 2021. And he was with three other retired Air Force captains. So each were sharing their own personal stories of UFO sightings over nuclear sites in different parts of the country. So Roberts was in Malmstrom, and there was a UFO sighting above Malmstrom. And then he came in for his shift, and he worked, underground, like in the control center, with one other member of the Air Force. And there were 10 ICBMs there, and they all went down at the same time as this UFO basically was spotted overhead. And he explained that these, ICBMs, they're not like they're all connected to each other. So if there was a technical glitch, which he said was incredibly rare that any technical glitch would happen, but if there was one, it wouldn't shut down all 10. It would shut down one because they were not connected to each other. So for 10 to shut down at the same time, you'd have to have 10 glitches happening at the same time. And given that one was incredibly rare, he couldn't imagine how could you have 10 at the same time? That makes no sense. So he was convinced that, this was somehow a UFO sending a message. And what's kind of interesting about that, and by the way, this had happened, I believe it's in the book, but I believe it was a week or 10 days earlier, another 10 at a nearby base had also shut down. So this was happening, 20 basically within the period of a couple of weeks, if not less. So what was causing this? And no one really looked into this further, of course. Not like this was ever acknowledged as being, some UFO came and shut down our ICBMs. That was certainly never acknowledged. And they were all asked to keep it quiet. All of them, all their experiences, they were asked to very forcefully asked to keep quiet, not politely, of course. So they kept quiet, out of fear. But now that this is decades ago, and they're all in their late 70s, early 80s, they're speaking up and sharing their experiences and trying to, let people know that these things have been happening and share the evidence. In fact, the Malmstrom case was brought up at one of the congressional hearings. I think May of last year, they talked about that and asked the UAP task force to look into it. So it became more official all of a sudden in 2022, all these years later, which is pretty interesting. Who knows if they're actually looking into it, but they were asked by a member of Congress to look into it. And that made it official. So yeah, it makes you wonder, so is there something happening? Are UFOs? I mean, one of the theories that came from the 50s, so this was, I said, the 60s. In the 50s, you had this whole group called the Contactees who were claiming to have all these UFO experiences, and the aliens were telling them that they were visiting Earth because they were concerned about the atomic age and the growth of the atomic age after World War II with the atomic bomb. And they thought that we were going to cause too much damage to Earth or to the solar system in general. So there was that kind of belief that they were here on a mission of, you know, sharing wisdom with us and trying to bring peace. And so there's that kind of thought kind of applied to the 60s as well. Obviously, we still have no answers to that, but it's an interesting thought that maybe there is something to the idea of them trying to protect us in some way. It's at least a comforting thought.
And what about the Robert Jacobs film as well? Because that seemed pretty weird.
Yeah, so he was one of the other members of the Air Force who was dealing with a case in California. And he was filming basically a test launch. And in that film, they later saw a test missile, basically like a dummy. And it changed its direction. They saw something fly in and basically alter its direction. And this made no sense other than like some other craft had come to intervene in this testing. And that film was basically shut down. He talked about his boss having some, you know, Men in Black type of character come in and basically take the film and shut the whole thing down and never to be spoken of again. And so he swears that this was his film that he took. He saw this and it was basically taken away. And he was kept quiet and he had threats against them. And he's convinced that what he saw is what he saw, you know, and that there was no other explanation for it. How did something in the atmosphere fly in, swoop in, and basically misdirect a dummy missile? So it's another fascinating case that, again, there's no one has an explanation like, oh, well, here's what happened. This is what he experienced, what he saw, and that's what he shared with us. So it's a fascinating case to put, you know, to include in the book.
And it's just occurred to me that we're talking about all this stuff as though it's definitely true, but it's not definitely true, I suppose. With Robert Jacobs, we've only got his word for it. And there's so much of this stuff where we'd be looking at it. And maybe we shouldn't talk about it as though it's definitely true. It's all possibles, isn't it? Because there isn't any proof.
You're right. And so again, like that's, I kind of mentioned this at the beginning, like I love sharing these stories. This is what people have experienced, what they believe to be true, you know, and it's up to the reader to take what they want from that. You know, do you want to believe this man who, you know, had again, these credentials and had this experience or not, you know, and there's really nothing else to base them because we don't have any other particular data. There aren't lots of other people involved with the case who can speak out. But it's a pretty interesting case. He had a lot of conviction in everything he was saying. He came across as incredibly genuine. I can say that at least. So, you know, maybe something did happen. And again, who knows? Maybe there is some other explanation for it. You know, everything that these guys said to have happened, maybe happened, but maybe there's just another explanation that has not been explained to us yet. Again, because we don't know everything.
There's three photos in the book I haven't seen before. They're from Alan Storm from 1967. How did you get hold of those?
Well, the Alan Storm photos, those I actually really want to get in. Those came from David Marler's archive. Yeah, he basically has so much in that archive. It's not just his collection, it's other collections he's acquired, including Project Blue Book files. And so that was one set of images that he said never been published before. So it was great to see those and be able to share anything I could share that hadn't been seen before.
And it's a thing nowadays, if new photos come out and videos, and you can't really trust any of it because there's so much CGI and there's Photoshop. People can be really clever with that stuff.
Yeah, well, it's getting worse and worse with that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's makes the truth harder for most everything.
But with Alan Storm, if the photos genuinely are 1967, I suppose it's harder to fake them.
Yeah, I mean, people were still pretty clever back then. I mean, you see like the George Adamski photos, you know, from the 50s. And they could do different kinds of setups with different kinds of materials to create these illusions. So there's definitely some creative, you know, pre-Photoshop work being done by some people. But there are some where, you know, you look at it and you're like, yeah, that one's a little harder to explain. And who knows? So again, it's all of these things are still kind of, you know, open mysteries, which is what makes them extra fascinating.
And do you find there are cases where parts of it you can accept, but other parts you can't? An example would be, say, Rendlesham Forest and the initial kind of stuff that happened with the memo and the recording that was done in the forest, and you can hear him talking about what he sees. And you think, okay, I can accept that. But then you get this thing about a binary code and humans from the future. And so these are two different parts of the same case. But one for me, binary code and humans from the future, that's just going too far.
I think that's a really good example. And I agree. I mean, something happened there in 1980, and it's pretty interesting. And again, you've got a lot of people who were looking into it. And I spoke with Colonel Holt, who was there, which was great to get his perspective on things, because there's a lot of information out there with people, you know, skeptics offering explanations for a lot of it. Again, very interesting to hear those perspectives, but also interesting to hear from someone who was physically there on the spot at that time. So it was great to be able to share, you know, obviously both sides of that story. And it seems like, yeah, okay, so something may have happened there, but, you know, something landed. What was it? You know, was it extraterrestrial? Was it some sort of testing by some kind of, you know, secret government project? Don't know for sure. But the binary thing is definitely odd, and it came about years later. And the translation of it is, again, how accurate is that? Is it really time travelers? I find time travel to be a tough one to understand and get my head wrapped around. I feel like traversing great distances in space and the idea of life existing on other planets is easier to accept than time travel to me. But again, we don't know everything, so who's to say? But yeah, I would say that binary code surfacing years and years after the fact from memory, and then being explained as time travelers is a little tougher to buy into than the idea that something happened there, that people experienced.
And it's a case that's got so many people contributing to it, and then so many skeptical people criticizing it, and you get into a kind of blizzard of noise, and you lose the original kind of description of what happened. And the same thing's happened with Roswell, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of people who were chiming in on Rendlesham, and some people were claiming to have been there and giving stories that were not true at all, you know, so completely muddies the waters. That's why, like I said, I think talking to Colonel Holt was especially helpful, because I find him to be believable. I don't think he's making anything up. He's more credible. And you got to hear from a firsthand. I mean, he wasn't there to see the actual crap, but he was there in the aftermath to do the investigations and everything. So that's pretty close to, I'd say, a firsthand experience. Roswell is another really interesting one, because that's basically got 30 years between the event and anyone really talking about it. And that's kind of something I don't know how many people are aware of the fact that Roswell, as amazing of a case that was, there were so many cases happening at that time in July of 1947. People were seeing UFOs all across the country, almost like daily. I mean, it's amazing, the flurry of accounts. So July 8th, you know, you have the Roswell Daily Record announcing that the Army had recovered a flying saucer, basically acknowledging, like, using those words. And that was the press release that they gave, was that they recovered this flying saucer. Which is amazing, right? That they acknowledged this and said, yeah, that we got one. And then the next day, of course, retracted it and said it was a weather balloon. So never mind. And then basically, you know, within a couple of days after that, the story just faded away. That was it. And then there were probably other UFO sightings. You know, people moved on and saw their things, and there were other stories. It wasn't until about 30 years later that a ufologist named Stanton Friedman started to investigate the case. He'd been tipped off to someone who had experiences there, and spoke with the son of, or spoke with Jesse Marcel, who was one of the Army personnel who recovered some of the materials. And he started having these conversations and meeting more and more people who were there at the time and gathering all these stories, which is amazing. And so he started finding out more things about it. From there, obviously, you get more belief that there was a conspiracy to cover up the actual UFO finding, that materials that they were brought for the press to see were then swapped out with other with normal materials so that the real materials were hidden from the press and the public. So that they could have their weather balloon story. So these are all the kinds of things that helped create the lore of Roswell. You had people saying that they saw, you know, small child-sized, you know, strange bodies with, some, you know, long, thin limbs and big heads. There were stories of a funeral home director getting calls for child-sized caskets to bury these aliens in. I'm not sure why they would even do that. So some of these things don't entirely make a lot of sense, but these are all stories that were coming out over the years. And eventually in 1994, the Air Force said, okay, here's the real story. It was the weather balloon wasn't just a weather balloon. It was a particular new kind of high altitude balloon that was designed to spy over Russia to check on their nuclear capabilities. And it was called Project Mogul, and it was top secret. So they had to basically cover up the whole thing. And that was what had crashed at Roswell. Of course, so many people didn't believe any of this. They said, well, that's just more cover-up stories. So again, who knows? It's so long past that you don't know how much people are remembering things accurately, maybe what's been suggested to them. It's hard to know for sure. So that's a good case where, like, there's some really interesting stories, and some of them start to sound a little bit more far-fetched, but they're all out there and they're all part of the lore and part of what makes the story so fascinating, you know, keeps Roswell interesting. And I love that Roswell's completely embraced all this, by the way. Like, you go to the town, and I've got a few images, I think, in the book, but you'll see, like, there's a McDonald's that's shaped like a flying saucer. There's a Dunkin' Donuts being held up by a 20-foot alien. The main street there is lined with streetlights that are shaped like alien heads. There's messages all over every business, you know, banks say, like, you know, welcome earthlings, open a savings account. You know what I mean? Like, everyone's embraced the culture there, which I think is really quite fun and interesting.
Yeah, and I think there's something to it, because I feel like what I heard was that the guy that first found the materials was Mac Brazel, which was the guy that worked on the ranch. And he thought these materials were weird. But also the Roswell Army Airfield would release weather balloons themselves. And so people in that area knew what they looked like and that they would come down on that ranch. So Mac Brazel would have seen them before on his ranch. And so coming across this other stuff that he didn't recognize when he's used to seeing them, that sort of stands out a little bit to me. And also, why would they put out a press release saying we've managed to obtain one of these flying discs when all they had was some tin foil and bits of wood?
Right. Well, and some of what's thought is that some of those materials were newer materials, like the Mylar material was something that hadn't been seen by other people, really, in general, the general public. And so that would have appeared unusual. So there's some thoughts of that, like the fact that it was this top secret new technology that was being tested is why maybe that appeared to be unusual. On the other hand, there's stories of some of these metals being able to be bent up and then resume their original shape immediately, which is not something that we have. So again, we don't exactly know. Like, there's different stories that keep it unexplained, right? I think that the government would have, to me, it feels like if the Project Mogul story is the real story, then it feels like they would have potentially tried to cover that up with a UFO story, which was so popular at the time. So that would be an explanation for it. And then quickly realized that was a bad idea. Mm-hmm. Why did we just say that and try to cover that up immediately with the other story? So that seems like one possibility, just overexcitement. And I don't know, a bad idea to have done that. But it's interesting. I you know, have the press release covered in the book that was what was dictated to be put out to everybody. So it's definitely one of the most remarkable cases out there.
And what do you make of Colonel Philip Corso and all the things he claimed to have been involved with?
Well, so that, you know, that's a tough one. I don't know. He's one of these guys who said that he saw these alien bodies. You know, he witnessed this because they were brought to Wright-Patterson in Ohio. And that, you know, that he was convinced that he saw alien creatures that were recovered from Roswell. So, you know, did he, you know, again, it's his word. I don't know. It's one of those stories that's out there, but you have to choose whether or not you choose to believe that one. I did share one explanation I thought was really interesting from one of the planetary scientists I spoke with named Pascal Lee, who wanted to share a theory with me. As a scientist, you know, you always have to have data and peer review to publish anything, but I don't need that. So he allowed me to publish his idea, just all speculation, of course. Again, no data to support this, but an interesting terrestrial explanation that accounted for what people claim to have seen. And so his thought was that maybe what happened at Roswell was indeed a high altitude balloon test, but they may have been also testing the biological effects, you know, testing biometrics on what high altitude would do to a human being. And to do that, they would have used monkeys. And there was, in fact, data for monkeys being launched into high altitude craft as early as 1948 in New Mexico. So is it possible that it was a few months earlier as well, but just not out there for the public to find that data? Seems quite possible. But they would have shaved the monkey to put those biometric readers, you know, all over the monkey to test and see what was going on with its, you know, physiology. So a shaved monkey would look a lot like what people described to have seen all those years later. They would have been childlike in size. They would have had long limbs, thin, gray skin, and big heads. And that would look really weird. You know, that would be an odd sight to see. And so he thought that maybe they were being used to not only test that, but maybe also to be trained to take photos over Moscow. At that time, you couldn't just take pictures remotely like we could, you know, now. You'd train a monkey to flip a switch, you know, flip a switch, take a picture, and it would get a banana chip or something like that as a treat, as a reward. So he thought, well, there's an explanation that might explain what was going on. It would align with the things that the government was trying to do at that time in terms of monitoring Russia's nuclear capabilities, testing with monkeys, and probably having some pretty bad results early on with monkeys and not wanting to talk about animal testing at that time. And so that may have, that was a thought. Maybe that's what happened. That's what people claim to have seen.
Yeah, it's fascinating that the way all these stories come up and all these ideas, and it's all part of the blizzard, I suppose. But one of the things you have in the book is the 17th century abduction of Anne Jeffries. And that was interesting. Did she say she thought they were fairies?
Yeah, and this is one of these interesting stories of people having experiences, you know, in history that they didn't have the language that we have now to describe certain things, right? So when they talk about being, you know, seeing small creatures wearing, you know, green uniforms and then taking them up into space and flying through the air, is that their way of explaining an alien encounter? But they wouldn't have talked about flying saucers. They didn't have any aircraft. They just talked about being swooped through space and being revisited by these small creatures dressed in green, which is very interesting. And then no one believing them, no one believing her, by the way, or no one else seeing them. But she was convinced that this had happened to her in the 1700s. And it's just one of these weird little cases where maybe that they were just describing things that the best they could at that time. And is that an example of an early visitation from an extraterrestrial being? You know, who knows? It's an interesting possibility. I also thought it was interesting that it kind of, to me, aligns with the Jacques Vallée theory that all this sort of folklore creatures might be related in some way and could be, you know, some sort of other dimension that they're all coming from, and maybe that connects everything. So that was, I thought, an interesting example of that.
Yeah, I heard this idea that because it could be multidimensional, and there's the abductees, almost all of them talk about telepathic communication and how it might be linked, yes, to ESP. and that what we see of the ETs is what we impose upon them, and that people see greys because that's what's out there, like in society. But before the greys were around, people would see different types of ETs, and it's that our consciousness is affecting what they look like.
I think that's an interesting thought about it, though. I mean, you're right. Are people at this point, are people seeing things because it's been suggested it's already in their minds from somewhere else? They've seen something somewhere. What was interesting, like in terms of the grays, you know, when Whitley Strieber's Communion came out in the 80s with that famous image of that gray face, right? That what's become like the cliche alien illustration. It's the one that became the emoji, basically, right? Like the big head, yeah, with the big eyes and little slit for the mouth. That hadn't been really seen before. That was an interesting new version of an alien. And people, so many people said, like, I've seen that same thing. Like, people claim to have had the same vision. But so again, is there something to that? But now it does make you wonder, like, okay, well, this is sort of, aliens are so much in popular culture that are people projecting what they think it is, if it is some sort of telepathic experience that they're having? You know, again, the brain always fills in patterns in some way for us, subconsciously. So is that another example of it? It seems possible.
Yeah, another way to look at it, I suppose, is if it's aliens that we know that we're imposing upon it, why don't people see Chewbacca all the time or Mr. Spock?
I guess those aliens, maybe because they're not associated with any of these kinds of experiences. That's a good question, though. Like Chewbacca was, you know, he was a good guy who was like a sidekick, right?
Yeah.
Not abducting anyone. But that's a fun question, though.
One of the cases that I've always thought was a really good one is Travis Walton, because there was the witnesses that saw what happened initially with the UFO. And all the stuff afterwards is they never changed their stories, and they passed lie detector tests. And Travis Walton, I think he only remembers 20 minutes or so of 5 days that he was missing.
Yeah, his case is definitely interesting. You know, it happened in Arizona in the 70s. And like you said, he was with, I think it was about five friends, and they saw this craft off kind of in the woods as they were driving back from, they were loggers. They were driving, I think, home after their shift. And he stepped out and kind of walked over to this thing that they'd seen off the side of the road. And his friends kind of freaked out and took off as they saw their friend kind of get zapped by this beam coming down. And they came back after a while. They're like, oh, we should go back and get him. Why did we leave our friend? They go back, and of course he's gone and missing, like you said, for 5 days. And then he suddenly reappears, and he's like terrified of what happened. And in the meantime, no one could find him. Like there were search parties out looking for him during that period, and came up completely empty, and started thinking his friends had had some sort of foul play and had done something to Travis. But they maintained that they did not, of course. And Travis's story was this abduction story. And he did have memories. Like you said, he did have some memories that were in his mind still, not coming just through hypnotic regression session. So it's a pretty fascinating one. Like you said, they all took lie detector tests, all of them. And I think they all passed, but I think one maybe had one issue. But basically the fact that they all did so well, you know, certainly gives it a bit more credibility than other cases might, because for everyone to pass that well, seems harder for all of them to have faked it, right? To all get through it if it wasn't true. And like you said, he maintained his story. He didn't change it one bit up to this day. He maintains what happened and never changed up or gave conflicting information to make people say like, oh, you know, that explains it. So it's definitely one of the more interesting abduction cases out there. Of course, it was made into a great movie called Fire in the Sky, which I saw when I was growing up and loved, always kind of stayed in my mind. So definitely, I think one of the more interesting cases.
We've been talking about your book. It's called We Are Not Alone, and your website is weirdhistorian.com. Is that right?
Yeah, that's one of my sites where I write about all my passions for the weirder side of history. which I love. And then I also have a site for my books, which is called markhartsmanbooks.com. That's Mark with a C. So you'll see a glimpse of all my books there.
And people can get them on Amazon and other places.
Yeah, absolutely. They're all available on Amazon, bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble, any bookstore you go to, or any other place you order online.
Great. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun. Appreciate it, Simon.
And that was an interview with Mark Hartsman about his book, We Are Not Alone, The Extraordinary History of UFOs and Aliens Invading Our Hopes, Fears and Fantasies. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can hear the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And there are now nearly 100 episodes in the back catalogue. And please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast. There are over 280 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence for an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of the Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is the Past Lives Podcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. I think you mentioned cattle mutilations as well, and they seem pretty weird and maybe evidence of something happening.
There's a lot of those cattle mutilation stories happening. I mean, they've happened. I mean, they're reported in many states here, you know, across America.